This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And away we go. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. My name is Richard Serrett. This is the Conspiracy Show, broadcasting live from the Great White North and our flagship station, AM 740, Zoomer Radio in Toronto. Howdy to everyone listening in on one of our growing list of U.S. affiliates. I think we're up to about 30 now. And speaking of which, I wish we had a drum roll. But I'd like to welcome a brand new affiliate, WLIP, WLIP AM 1050, Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. Thanks, WLIP, for including The Conspiracy Show as part of your weekly lineup. We are delighted. And I would love to hear from Pleasant Prairians. If that's what you're called, Pleasant Prairians in Wisconsin, the Dairy State. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show, and welcome to all of you listening on the podcast as well. You know, I'd like to, my intern, story producer, Albert, and I were talking about this before the show. We'd like to develop some kind of an app. Everyone has apps now. We need an app. So maybe I can enlist one of you all listening. If you have some experience with apps, what we'd like to do is be able to deliver the podcast right to your iPhone or your smartphone. And of course, being a complete Luddite or a techno peasant, I do not have the wherewithal to figure that out. But if one of you listening perhaps has some experience in developing an app and you'd like to assist, I would love to hear from you. And you can send me an email at theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. TheConspiracyShow1@gmail.com. We're also live streaming again tonight, the program being offered as a hangout on air. And the YouTube, or the link to the live stream on YouTube, is available on my Twitter feed, which is at Richard Serrett. At Richard Serrett. So if you go to the Twitter feed, scroll down a few tweets. It might be actually at the top. I think Albert refreshed that, so there's a brand new tweet at the top, and you just click on the link. And incidentally, while you're on the Twitter feed, why don't you follow? Had a great time hosting the JFK special last night on Coast to Coast, and fellow Canadian Brent Holland joined me in the first 2 hours. Brent developed kind of a close relationship with JFK's, one of his biggest supporters, speechwriters, the man responsible for all of those immortal words, ask not what your country can do for you and so forth, Ted Sorensen. Brent holds the distinction of having been the last person to interview Ted Sorensen, and some amazing revelations on the program last night. Hope you had a chance to listen in. Here's something I didn't know. 2 days before the assassination, so we're talking November 20th, Dallas police apparently witnessed, I believe it was two men, they had rifles with scopes. I don't know if they were loaded in, whether they actually fired live ammo, but they were pointing these rifles with scopes at a parked vehicle, a convertible, don't you know, parked on the side of the road, somewhere in Dealey Plaza. And in the back seat of the parked convertible were two cardboard cutout silhouettes of two people. sort of sounds like, oh, I don't know, a bit of a dry run for what transpired 2 days later. Duh, do you think? Wow, quite a revelation. Speaking of Coast, I'll be back on hosting December 13th and 14th, which Eastern Time would be the early hours of the 14th and 15th. And on the early mornings of the 15th, December the 15th, I'll be joined by my good friend Victor Vigiani, Executive Director of Zealand News Network, which is a news service dedicated to the compilation, distribution, analysis of news relating to the disclosure of information concerning the extraterrestrial presence engaging the planet as manifested by the UFO phenomenon. And Victor will be with me in hours 2, 3, and 4. So that's, if you're in the Eastern time zone, that's 2 a.m., December the 15th. And as it happens, Victor is here with me in studio tonight as well. Hello, Victor. How are you, my friend?
Just fine, thank you. Great to be here again.
We haven't spoken since my Follow the Truth conference mm-hmm. in Oshawa last week. Did you enjoy yourself?
An incredible event. Incredible event. I just was really just sitting there all day long, watching and listening, as I guess an onslaught of information came forward in a way that I haven't seen it before done that way. And every single one of the guests was captivating and compelling. And the thing that I guess it got me the most is everything was so different. You really hit it. You rang a whole lot of different bells. And you really attracted a lot of attention to a lot of different ideas and concepts that, you know, agree with them or not.
Some of it you've no doubt heard before. Don Schmidt, of course, was there on Roswell. Yeah. Jim Peniston joined mm-hmm. us via Skype and talked about Rendlesham. And, of course, you were in Washington a year and a half ago. For the citizens' hearing on disclosure, and heard and right. saw Jim's testimony firsthand.
Yeah, his testimony was very, very compelling, and you could tell that having spoken to him in Washington in May of 2013, over a period of time over the 5 days that I was there, a very tender man in terms of almost frail with respect to the way he was doing what he was doing. He was definitely under a lot of pressure, and he seems to have kind of gotten by that, but there's still some remnants of it in the way he put himself forward.
I don't think he likes to travel, which is why he did the conference by Skype.
Yeah.
I don't
think he likes a lot of attention either, to be quite honest with you.
No, never has. I mean, that's not what this is about for him. No. And you know, you got to drag this information out of him. He's not, you know, someone who is looking, as you say, for a lot of publicity. Yeah. 30 years, you know, since more than 30 years, and now he's decided, okay, well, I'll tell my side of the story and write a book. Yeah. But it's certainly not about publicity and money, and for any of these people,
of
obviously.
Course. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, as I say, a year and a half since the citizens' hearing on disclosure down in Washington, and just a bevy of veritable who's who, really, from the UFO ET arena gave testimony before members. Former members of the United States Congress. There were six former congressmen and women. And the whole effort, of course, orchestrated by the indefatigable Stephen Bassett, executive director of the Paradigm Research Group, who, of course, is a registered lobbyist in Washington and continues to work tirelessly to end the 70-year UFO ET truth embargo. Earlier this month, he launched another initiative involving all of the testimony that's been made available now on DVD, and Stephen Bassett is with us to tell us about that. Stephen, how are you?
Richard, Victor, it's great to be with you as always.
So, this initiative, which began, I believe, November the 5th, involving all of this testimony that has been beautifully produced and placed on DVD, what are you doing with this material, Stephen?
Well, the DVD video record of the citizen hearing was shipped to the Congress on the 5th, and by that I mean all 538 offices of the House and Senate. Each set has 10 DVDs in it with roughly three hours on each DVD, so 30 hours of video record. And the Senate was shipped in bulk and would have arrived first, and then the House was shipped media mail. So this probably didn't start arriving in the offices until about, I'm going to guess, the 18th, 19th, a few days ago. And they'll be arriving all next week. And at the same time, and these were non-commercial DVD sets. Right. They were created for the lobbying effort only. They didn't need to be commercial quality. But finally, and it's been a long time, it's been a very difficult year and a half. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, that's an expensive endeavor. That's an expensive endeavor.
Not the least of which the U.S. Congress has had a bad year and a half, too, I should say. But the commercial quality of the CHD is available online now to download at citizenhearing.org. And soon, the DVD sets, commercial quality DVD sets, will be available for purchase, as well as to the donors that contributed to the editing campaign. So we're underway. We brought things back to life. Now, look, it took longer than I wanted it to. There's no question.
Yeah, it's been a year and a half since the hearing.
But I have to say that I did not really think that Congress could get much worse, or things could get much worse in Washington, but they did. And the last year and a half has been just god-awful. And I'm not too regretful of having not dived into that in the middle of the mess, because it has been one political hearing after another, the usual gridlock. And we're running a little late on this, on the initiative we launched, frankly, because there was a lot of logistic issues still to be dealt with. And that's not too bad either, because, again, we had the immigration issue blow up shortly after, well, and since the election. I mean, normally the lame-duck Congress is a very quiet time. The politics cools off. The hearing, political hearings stop. The members go home. The staff is sitting around. And it's a good time to get in and meet with staff and so forth. But as you know, President Obama issued an immigration directive, so everybody got all fired up again, and then they went home. So as it turns out, I'm not going to start approaching offices until after Thanksgiving.
Well, that was my next question, is because, you know, there are some new members coming in, some members leaving.
Yeah.
In terms of the timing, are the new members that are coming in going to receive a copy, or are some of the ones
of
that are – okay.
Yeah, the new members coming in will be sent copies of the DVDs after – well, when they come in, which is after January the 3rd. However, the old members are still in office till the end of the year. Their staff is still there. And if they're on the right committees, I'll probably approach those offices, because there's still a possibility to get support from them. And develop some interest and build a platform in the remaining, I guess, a little over a month.
So how is this being presented to them? Are they just getting a box dropped off at their office with these 10 CDs, 30 hours of testimony? How is it being presented?
All right. Each office is receiving the DVD set. There's a letter attached to it to the member, signed by the witnesses of the citizen hearing, 40-some signatures on there, calling for the member to review this record, this video record, calling on the office to meet with me, and saying that these witnesses want hearings. They did the citizen hearing. Now they want to come up on the Hill and, under federal penalty of perjury, tell the truth to an actual hearing.
That's key. Wow. Yes,
so
under federal penalty of perjury.
This, we've been running a social media campaign. And that's what your listeners need to know about tonight for sure. This social media campaign is extremely important. The whole goal of it is to make sure the boxes, the DVD sets get opened.
Okay.
By staffers.
Stephen, hold on. We'll take a timeout. When we come back, we'll talk about the Twitter storm and the other aspects of this social media campaign. Stephen Bassett is with us, the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group and the man behind the citizen hearing on disclosure, which happened a year and a half ago, May of 2013. 30 hours of testimony now being presented to all the current members and incoming members of the United States Congress. Victor Vigiani in studio, executive director of Zealand News Network. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. Richard Serrett with you. And if you're joining us on the live stream, watching us on the Hangout on Air, I'd love to hear from you, how you're enjoying it. And you can drop us an email at theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. Do I have that right, Albert? theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of the Paradigm Research Group, is with us talking about this new initiative involving the 30 hours of testimony from the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure, which took place back in May of 2013. And he's here to tell us about the social media campaign designed to galvanize support and urge the congressmen and women, all members of the United States Congress who have received the 30 hours of this testimony on DVD, urging them to screen the material and then respond to it. Victor Vigiani, I should mention. Victor Vigiani, our good friend, executive director of Zealand News Network, is here as well. So tell us about this social media campaign, Stephen, and then I'll turn things over to Victor.
Well, sir, it's very simple. We need the staff of the offices to open a DVD set, look at it. Not watch the whole 30 hours, but look at any part of it, frankly. Once that happens, the door opens, and we can make, I think, pretty rapid progress. So how do we get them to do that? Well, starting on March the 5th, we launched a social media campaign to send a lot of messages into the Congress with these three points. One, you've got DVDs coming. You've got a DVD set called A Citizen Hearing on its way. We want you to look at it. Two, we want you to meet with Paradigm Research Group lobbyist Steve Bassett, and we want hearings for these witnesses on the Hill, real hearings on the Hill. Three basic messages. So, to rehash just a little bit, the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure website is citizenhearing.org. There you can find and download and acquire a commercial quality version of the Citizen Hearing from a year and a half ago. Now, the social media campaign is being run out of several locations. The primary one is factsonwashington.org. F-A-X on Washington.org, factsonwashington.org. On Facebook, the page is the Disclosure Lobby. It's got the information there. And there's another website, disclosure.media. Media is an extension. It's one of the new extensions, disclosure.media. You will also find the information there. And that information basically has the links so that you can go relatively easily find the page, the top web page for most of the members of the House and Senate, and there you can find their Twitter icon and their Facebook icon. So you hit on the Twitter icon and you tweet them, as many as you can. Now, and not once, but wait a few days and tweet them again. In other words, you need to pop as many tweets as possible into these offices all the way through the rest of this month and well into November.
Are you still using the fax? Because people, lest they think that that's old technology, you know, emails.
I know,
that's
just the name of the site, but no, we're not using the fax.
Okay, because, you know, some still do use faxes, and it's a lot easier, for example, to erase an email than it is, you know, faxes tend to pile up on desks and it kind of makes an impact.
Don't think of it that way.
No?
Let me finish this thing and I'll tell you why. It's cool. It'll work. It's all right. So you got your Twitter, so people can tweet, and we have a bunch of sample tweets there, what they look like, you know, how to get the message across. Obviously, you can't get it all in one tweet, so you send several, and you wait a few days and you send some more, and you hit as many members as you've got the time. I've got one person that has sent something like 20,000 so far. In any event, you also have the Facebook icon there, so you can pop on that, and you can go to their Facebook page, and you can post on it this information. Obviously, you're not limited to 144 characters, and you can also message them on Facebook. By the way, the hashtag for all of this, for those that understand hashtags, is disclosure. Hashtag disclosure. Now, there's also links to their email form pages. Fewer and fewer members actually have email addresses. They use form pages, so you can send emails to them. So we have three kinds of messages that are coming, raining down on them in this media storm or tweet storm, whatever you want to call it. Tweets, Facebook postings and messages, and emails. Now, here are the rules. One, anybody in the world can send a tweet or a Facebook post. And when I was in Europe, I just recently did 12 lectures in Europe, 7 countries, and the enthusiasm there for this was as great as it was here in the U.S., and they're all sending tweets and emails, or rather tweets and Facebook posts from Europe. Anyone can do it. Anyone in the world, there's no limit. When it comes to the emails, it's different. You can send an email through the form pages to any of the senators, but you have to have a U.S. address. You can only send an email to your representative, right, by putting in an address in your district with a proper zip code. And unless you can come up with an address and a proper zip code for some other representative district, you can't email them. They limit it that way.
Okay, so for our Canadian listeners, then you want to go through the Twitter or the Facebook option.
Right.
And if for American listeners, choose your congressman or woman that represents your district and use their email form if you choose to do the email.
And then, but town the Senate, because you can email the entire Senate.
You
just have to put a U.S. address in.
All right.
So that's how we're directing these messages. Now, why does this work? Well, you see, every office has somebody designated to check everything that comes through on the Facebook page, on Twitter, and on email. Believe me, they check them all. And the reason they have to check them all is because you never know when something will come through which could be really important, right, to the member, to their boss, in other words. In other words, if something is breaking out there, and you've seen how this has happened repeatedly, something turns up on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, and it poses a huge problem for the member, and often several members have actually lost their jobs because of stuff that's developed in social media. So they follow everything. Now, something comes through, it's not a big issue or immediately gets their attention. They look at it, it goes by. But when 100 or 1,000 come through on the same subject, they notice that, and that's when things get passed up to the boss, to the chief of staff, and they make a decision. Look, there's something going on here. What is this disset about? What's going on with this? We need to check it out. So, in other words, you're just hitting with so many messages over a number of days, a number of weeks, that they realize this is something they must engage. So it's not about being able to erase or not erase. It's about being hit over and over and over and over again. Now, to give you There's one easy way. There's a number of ways to check Twitter levels, Twitter analytics, many sites, but one I like is Topsy.com. That's T-O-P-S-Y, Topsy.com. If you go to Topsy.com and you click on the social analytics section at the top, and then you go ahead and search on the hashtag disclosure, you will see that on November the 5th, when this thing started, the number of disclosure tweets, or tweets with disclosure hashtag, jumped up substantially, went up like 6,000, went up something like 12,000 a day, and then dropped on down, but it's been running between 4,000 and 8,000 a day since the 5th of November. So do the math. What's it? That's about 17 days. That's 100 and maybe 100,000, over 100,000 tweets. And that's just those tweets that have the hashtag included. Doesn't count tweets that doesn't have the hashtag. So you can see, just on that alone, we are definitely pounding them with messages, but of course they're also getting emails and Facebook posts. We need this to go on through at least the mid-November, December. And so we need people to get on board. Facts on Washington.org, FAX on Washington.org, you can get the info. You can go to the Facebook page, the Disclosure Lobby. You can also go to the website, disclosure.media. And there's also a very lengthy interview that I did recently that's gets into a lot of this and covers it, that people might get some help from, and that is at ivolvetv.com. That's I-V-O-L-V-E, ivolvetv.com/auditorium, or just .com, go to the auditorium section. You'll see an interview by me where I get into this.
All right. Stephen Bassett is with us, the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. In studio, Victor Vigiani from Zealand News Network, as we discuss the latest initiative, this social media storm, to urge the current sitting members of Congress and those that will be coming into Congress in January, in the new year, to screen the material, some of the 30 hours of eyewitness testimony that was presented at the citizen hearing on UFO disclosure back in May of 2013, Victor.
Yeah, Steve, that's a good outline of the process. I'm thinking back to the 5 days that I spent, you know, with you in Washington back in early May of 2013. Mm-hmm. And I watched in awe, literally, as the heads and minds of each one of those congressmen or congresswomen and men and yeah. the one senator, Mike Gravel, watching them literally do a 180-degree turn on the issues that were brought forward by people like, you know, Richard Dolan and A.J. Guevara and Stanton Friedman, you name it. It just keeps on going on and on. And not only did they individually listen to the testimony and were literally gobsmacked by it, obviously, but one by one, they became convinced. But there was another process in place during the 5 days, a little bit of cross-pollination and dialogue among these congressmen and congresswomen and the one senator regarding what was going on here. I guess my question to you is, what kind of cross-pollination after all of these emails and tweets and all of that go to these people in the thousands, what kind of, or would you assess there might be the cross-pollination of Congress people talking to one another as members saying, what's all this about? Are you counting on that kind of cross-pollination? And,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Look, we basically sent 5,380 DVDs to Capitol Hill to 538 offices that are staffed by about 10,000 people. And all of them have computers. All of them have access to DVD players. And so anyone could look at this material. Now, these people have lunch together. They know they have friends in other offices. Many of the staffers have media connections that, you know, they go to, right, with when they want to get their members word out and all that. It's a giant network. It's a huge network. And we're dropping 5,380 DVDs in the middle of this. And then we're barraging them with emails, tweets, and Facebook posts to create, clearly, some sort of viral situation where they start talking to each other about this. I mean, that's the idea. And what they see, and this is where we have a shot. This is why we may have a shot to pull this off. They've been given something unprecedented. It's never been done before like this. What they have and what they will see is exactly what you said. They will see six former members of the Congress that were colleagues of many of these members. Probably the majority of these members have been colleagues or one or more of these members. Two of them, Lynn Woolsey and Roscoe Bartlett, a Republican and Democrat, they retired just the January before the citizen hearing after with 20 years. That's 10 terms in the Congress. So they're going to see colleagues of theirs with 80 years of tenure come into a hearing on the most important subject in the world that has been suppressed by government policy of truth embargo, basically on the fence on this issue, not biased toward it at all, skeptical even, and they're going to see them profoundly affected by this testimony. So it's going to take a huge amount of the risk out of the decision, ultimately, to hold hearings. But it also shows them that this may be the best opportunity that Congress has had a long time to do something profound, something that will grab the world's attention, something that will move things forward and reclaim from the American people the trust and esteem that they have squandered over the last 30 or so years, and now down to an 11% rating. So the citizen hearing is the key to the door if we get them to look at it.
Now, further to that goal.
We're going to be doing a media campaign. We may have we're hoping to raise some money, hopefully at least $20,000, maybe from one wise futurist person who wants this done, to bring our publicist in so that she can work the entire 3 months, December, January, and February. Along with, of course, my media work to get the mainstream media on this as well. Now, we had a lot of coverage for the citizen hearing. We had a lot of articles. If you go to the media section at citizenhearing.org, you can see these articles. But that was a single event. This is a three-month endeavor, the most comprehensive effort ever to get hearings on the ET issue on Capitol Hill. So we have a lot of opportunity to get media coverage, to get network news shows and so forth, or talk shows.
Stephen, we're going into a break here. Just a quick question, though, a quick yes or no answer. Did you provide members of Congress with a sizzle reel, sort of a highlights reel, if you will, at the sort of the top end of the 30, for those that we know their attention span, is there a highlight reel there for them?
Yeah, it's deliberate.
Excellent.
Key information is right on the box, and we want them to go in and see the process unfold.
All right.
Sizzle reel doesn't quite get it across. It shows you some highlights. You say, oh, something happened. You put it away, and you don't watch anything else. We want them to watch this testimony unfold.
Gotcha. All right. Stephen Bassett stays with us, Executive Director of the Paradigm Research Group, Victor Vigiani, Executive Director of Zealand News Network. See, we've got two executive directors. Only the heavy hitters will do on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. Hey, and we are back. Victor Vigiani in studio, Executive Director, Zealand News Network, and Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of the Paradigm Research Group. We're talking about his latest initiative, this social media storm, which is sort of working in concert with he sent all the members of Congress, however, at House of Representatives and the Senate. They've all received 30 hours of testimony from the citizens' hearing on UFO disclosure, which happened in May of 2013. And Victor, you and I were talking off the air just during the break.
Yeah.
How the idea of having a real hearing where these same witnesses would do it all over again. The importance isn't that they're speaking to current sitting members of Congress. To me, the key is they are under oath under federal law. If they perjure themselves, I mean, they could do time.
Of course.
So if you're sitting there watching an actual hearing and these witnesses are saying these things under oath, to me, that's very powerful.
Well, when I saw that kind of happen at the citizen hearings that Steve had back in May of 2013, it was a mock hearing. We all understand that. But you have to be sitting there in the National Press Club and watching these people stand before they give their testimony and actually swear that what they're saying is the truth before these congressional members. So when you
but
get
not a, under federal law of perjury.
Of course not, no. But the whole idea of what Steve did was to replicate that feeling, and he did a damn good job of it, let me tell you, because you could feel the tension in the room, and you could feel each individual as they testified, and Steve could speak to this, that they did. There was a gravitas about what they said, why they were saying it, and when you watch the congressional members actually listen to it and make eye contact with it with the witnesses, you could see there was something very important going on. Now, if we can replicate that, if Steve can replicate that in real hearings and know that the people that are listening to this under penalty of law, and if you perjure yourself, it's big trouble, I think there's a strong motivation behind people to come forward and for the congressional people to actually take it seriously, because who's going to want to lie in front of a congressional hearing?
Well, that's the key, isn't it, Stephen? Under penalty of loss, an oath.
Oh, sure, but guess what, guys? I got a treat for you. You ready?
Ready.
So I'm on the show, and there's somebody listening to the show, and they send me an email saying, have you seen this article? So I immediately checked the article out. God, I love the Internet. And so what's happened here is the first article about the CHI, the Congressional Hearing Initiative, has hit the political press. It was in today's Washington Times, the Inside the Beltway section, which is very heavily read, just by everybody that will read the Washington Times.
This just happened now while you were on this show? Someone sent you a link?
That's right. So I'm going to read you what was in the Washington Times today in the Inside the Beltway section from the always wonderful Jennifer Harper. Heading, Aliens from Elsewhere. While Congress and the White House argue over illegal aliens, Stephen Bassett, founder of the Paradigm Research Group and a registered lobbyist, continues to demand that lawmakers and officials tell what they know about aliens, as in extraterrestrials. The determined Mr. Bassett already organized a citizen hearing on disclosure last year at the National Press Club. A DVD of the 30-hour-long close encounter between witnesses, six former congressmen, she meant congresspersons, law enforcement experts, and assorted journalists was sent to all members of Congress on November the 5th as a matter of fact. Mr. Bassett now says he will renew a renewed direct engagement with lawmakers and has organized an aggressive social media campaign among like-minded voters who also want answers about UFO sightings, alien technology, and other matters. Congress last addressed the issue in 1968. Hang on a second. It goes on. I'm just trying to pull up the next page. Here we go. Let's see. This, quote, this will be a concentrated three-month effort accompanied by a substantial media coverage. If congressional hearings are held, it is quite likely the truth embargo will collapse, Mr. Bassett predicts. Now, Is there anything that she left out there? I mean, that is it. That is the exact description of what is going on in the Washington Times today. So now the game has begun.
Not a hint of sarcasm or anything in that article. This is a sea change, wouldn't you say?
Well, no. There's been plenty of articles about PRG's work and the Citizen Hearing that did not have sarcasm. There were some that did. But I can tell you the vast majority of all articles about this issue, by and large, don't have sarcasm.
Okay, but that is a fundamental change in the approach of the media.
Well, I think with Jennifer, and I've spoken to Jennifer a couple of times, and she is solidly aware of what's going on. And what kind
I kept her informed for years.
Yes.
She's on top of it. She does her part. She reports properly what's going on. And, we like her a lot. But, again, there's going to be more articles. You see where this is going. That's the very first article. We intend to get as many as we can, and I'm going to try to get on every talk show there is. We've got a hell of a story here. And this is, for your audience, what's going down. And as I said, they can be involved. They can help make this happen because, and I really can't overstate this too much. If a committee on Capitol Hill decides that they will indeed allow these witnesses, not one or two or three to come up for a half day, I'm talking about 20, 30 witnesses or more coming up to testify over many days. Nothing unusual about that, believe me. That kind of comprehensive hearing. If a committee agrees to do that, it is possible it will trigger disclosure in and of itself because the media is going to get extremely worked up about that.
No question, Stephen.
Once they get worked up, things can move pretty quickly.
Absolutely. All right, one more time out. We'll come back. Stephen Bassett, Paradigm Research Group, Victor Vigiani, Zealand News Network. The Citizens Hearing on UFO disclosure being taken to the next level. We'll discuss further when the conspiracy show continues. Don't go away. And we continue on with our discussion with Stephen Bassett, the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group, and his efforts, of course, to end the 70-year UFO truth embargo. In studio, Victor Vigiani, the executive director of Zealand News Network. And we were talking about the media coverage. You mentioned an article in the Washington Times by Jennifer Harper, a hard-nosed journalist who wrote about your efforts, Stephen, and what's going on, this social media campaign that you're launching. And she wrote a solid, credible piece without a trace of sarcasm. And, Victor, you had an excellent point about what Jennifer Harper's role could be in this whole thing.
Yeah, in speaking with her before, and we exchange emails all the time, and, we've always sort of kind of exchange ideas as to what Steve is doing, why he's doing it. I kind of think that could be that Jennifer could be the Woodward or Bernstein of this if she's supplied some poignant information and can cut through some of the glass ceiling that she's exposed to. And she's obviously being allowed to write about this, but how intrusive will her articles be, and how much more of a push could she exert to get these things, these hearings brought forward just by simple pressure on her part? And we all know what kind of pressure journalists can and do have on political figures.
What do you think, Stephen? Is Jennifer Harper your Woodward or your Bernstein in all this?
No. We don't want to load her up too much. She does the Inside the Beltway column, which covers lots of stuff. And her role is to let people know something's coming down the pike. Right? Give them a heads up. She's not an investigative journalist in that sense. Now, understand, another 9 journalists in Washington received a set of DVDs about a week ago, carefully selected. So a few more will get them soon. Then DVDs are going to go out to certain members of the White House, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm letting things develop, in an appropriate way. This is just the first article. I'm just saying that this tweet storm, and the power of social media is continuing to demonstrate itself every month. You always see something. It is the engine that engine that can drive almost any issue if people are sufficiently motivated.
Well, if it can bring a regime in Egypt to its knees, surely it can convince some Congress people to open up a box and sit in front of a TV or their DVD player for a couple of hours. Give us some insight, Stephen, on how easy or difficult would it be for an official congressional hearing on this subject to be called. How difficult or easy?
This is the reason. You see, I believe that if we can get hearings, we can probably get disclosure pretty quickly thereafter. And the reasons for that are many. But again, when the media is confronted with the prospect that dozens of witnesses of rank and station, not just anybody now, you know the kinds of witnesses we're talking about. We call them military political agency witnesses, rank and station people, like Edgar Mitchell, like Paul Hillier, former defense minister of Canada, like pilots and former captains in the Air Force SAC operations and so forth. So
the guys that guard the nukes.
Yeah, when the media is confronted with them actually going on the Hill and testifying under oath, that's it. They are going to jump in, and when the media jumps in, there are 1,000 questions that they could ask, and the government does not want to have to answer those questions, and probably the ball game is over. And then the other cool thing about it is hearings are very easy to get. It's very difficult to pass a law, believe me. And you want to get a law passed, my friend, well, welcome to it.
I've seen Mr. Smith goes to Washington. I know.
Yeah. Well, it's even harder than that. It's got to go through the House, got to go through the Senate, it's got to get through the committees and be voted on. A hearing is nothing. They can call a hearing in a day, and they've done it, right? Something will happen, and the Senate will say, we're having a hearing Wednesday, and get X number of people up here immediately, and they can do it. So, and any committee can call a hearing any time. There's no vote necessary. The committee chair pretty much decides.
Okay, let's get Victor again in here.
Would there be a specific committee that you would have your eye?
Eight that I'm looking at.
Which ones are there? Are the key ones? Would you figure?
Well, the four most appropriate would be the two science, technology, space science and technology committees, and the two intelligence committees. They would be the most appropriate. There's about another four, and we're just going to focus on those committees, and we're only going to focus on those members that sit on those committees. Obviously, I can't approach the whole House and Senate. We're going to focus on the people sitting on those committees with the idea to ultimately convince enough members of a committee to pressure or persuade the chairperson to go ahead and pull the trigger and call this hearing together. And then the other cool thing about it is that, remember, all we're asking is for them to listen to testimony, to sit and listen to testimony under oath, to get important information that they could make decisions about. We're not asking them to declare their view on the issue. We're not asking them to go in front of the press and say what they think about extraterrestrials one way or the other. They don't do anything. All we have to do is let the witnesses come and testify.
Because there is precedence here, Steve. We know, you and I both know, in 1968 that the symposium on UFO, I guess, inquiry before a committee. Now, the really interesting part about that, and I think our listeners should really take stock of this, is that one of the people who introduced Alan J. Hynek at the actual symposium was Donald Rumsfeld, senator at the time. And I think there is precedence for
it. Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Yes, he introduced Alan J. Hynek at the 1968 Congressional Symposium on a Study of UFOs.
And another thing that's very cool about that, in that one of the people that submitted a paper to that hearing also testified at the citizen hearing, and of course that's Dan Friedman, 45 years later, still at it. But let me be clear. While that hearing brought some, you know, was legitimate, there was legitimate information that was presented, it should have been followed up on. That's not what was going on, though. That hearing was done so the Congress could say they had a hearing. Shortly after that, as you may recall, they announced the results of the Condon Report, shut down Project Blue Book, and said we're out of the UFO business. And they haven't had a hearing since. And you know how many sightings there have been and how much evidence has emerged since 1968? I can assure you that those in the government who are tasked with managing this issue know full well that certainly since 91, the truth embargo could not withstand a proper congressional hearing, not three people in a half a day, 30 people over an entire week. It couldn't withstand it. And so every effort to get hearings the only ones I know about are since 92, and there have been many, have all been stopped cold. But this one's not being stopped. I have not been blocked. The witness has not been bothered. It's almost like they're saying, hey, if you can do it, do it. So we have a shot here.
All right, Stephen, give us the details on how people can participate in this social media storm.
Right. They need to go to faxonwashington.org, or they can go to the website disclosures.media, or they can go to the Facebook page, The Disclosure Lobby. They will find information and links, right, that will tell them the basic message they need to send to the U.S. Congress. That message is, you got some DVDs that have been sent to you. We want you to look at them, too. We want you to meet with the lobbyist, Stephen Bassett, to discuss the citizen hearing content in those DVDs. And we want hearings for these witnesses on Capitol Hill. Now, and you also will get the links. You'll have a link that will make it fairly easy for you to find all the pages of the members of Congress and then find their Facebook icon and their Twitter icon so that you can tweet the two-thirds of the House and Senate that have Twitter accounts, and you tweet them messages asking, you know, not one, not two, but a number of messages, double up, do it, repeat them every 4 days. Doesn't matter. They can't keep track. Just keep raining tweets down. I'm saying we want this DVD set opened. We want you to meet with Bassett. We want hearings. And hashtag it disclosure. The same thing in your Facebook post messages or posts on their Facebook page. And you can do all the members that have Facebook pages and Twitter accounts, you can do that. And also there are links to where you can easily get the email form pages for all the members of the House and Senate. You can email the entire Senate. You can email your congressperson. And email them as long as you want, but keep it to the point. And then wait a week and email them again. We need to rain emails, tweets, and Facebook messages down upon them. That's why it's called a social media storm, all through the rest of this month and at least halfway into December.
Okay, give us the links.
Fax, F-A-X on Washington.org, disclosure.media, and the Facebook page, The Disclosure Lobby. And you can find information about the citizen hearing at citizenhearing.org.
All right, Stephen, we'll have you on again in the next maybe month or so and track the progress. And congratulations on this initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sense you're really moving the ball forward on this one.
We got a shot here. We want everybody on board, and that includes Canada. Join the tweet storm, Canadians. Do your thing.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much for this.
All righty.
Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of Paradigm Research Group. Well, Victor, I mean, I'm impressed at the mm-hmm. how people like Jennifer Harper, now he says she's not an investigative reporter, but and I was corrected. I assumed that for the most part, mm-hmm. the mainstream media continues to approach the UFO ET subject with tongue firmly planted in cheek, with a bit of sarcasm. But that's not true. There is a sea change that's happened here.
It's more of it went from ridicule to tongue-in-cheek to just simple avoiding the issue, taking it seriously, but avoiding it. A lot of journalists that I speak to said, yeah, there's something going on there, but we just don't want to cover it.
No.
So we've moved forward now into another era of understanding, and whether there's a collective consciousness among journalists, you know, going at this kind of stuff, they're eventually going to pick up on it.
But they're writing about it in a serious way. That is a monumental leap forward.
Yeah. And people like Lee Spiegel at the Huffington Post.
Yeah. Right.
Lee's done a great job with this, and he covered all 5 days of the hearings. And as I've always said, he's got, I think, the best coverage written down about it day by day.
You know, it's the Huffington Post, very influential, but it's online. When you have a hard copy like the Washington mm-hmm. Times inside the Beltway column writing about this in a serious manner, that is a huge change.
It really is.
What do you think Stephen's chances are of getting an actual hearing in Washington with some of these same witnesses on UFOs?
I'm not even going to say 50-50. I think it could be greater than that. I think there's a good 7 out of 10 chance that he could pull this off. I really, really believe that because of the amount of support that he just might get for this and the cross-pollination among some of these members of Congress that could happen. It's going to go. There's just been too much pressure on this to stay put.
Could we see a citizens' hearing on Parliament Hill, Victor?
Hey, you never know what Zealand Communications can do with a little bit of information.
Victor Vigiani, I appreciate your time, as always.
It's a pleasure.
Hope you're enjoying our hangout on air. Would love to hear from you. Just email theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. Let Albert and myself know. How are you enjoying the live stream? The website, richardserrett.com, your portal to the program. And as always, follow the truth. Hey, thanks once again to WILP 1050 AM in Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, which is really part of the greater Chicago market, for adding us to your roster. And add WILP 1050 AM to our growing list of affiliates. And as I say, part of the greater Chicago market, so the Conspiracy Show now slowly starting to work its way into some of the major urban centers in the United States. And a big thanks to Chris Whitting and his team at Syndication Networks for the great job they're doing in building our little burgeoning Conspiracy Show network here. As I say, about 30 markets now in the U.S. and growing. Just a reminder, we are live streaming this on YouTube as a hangout on air. And if you want to watch the live stream, just go to my Twitter feed at Richard Serrett and scroll down. Actually, I think it's right at the top of the Twitter feed. And the tweet there contains the link to the live YouTube stream. You just click on it and voila, you are there. If you want to check out the archived stream later, you can go to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. And we've got a YouTube channel there, and you can watch the archived live stream. Last Sunday, after my Follow the Truth conference, Dr. Douglas Cottrell, the man with X-ray eyes, Canada's Edgar Casey, a good friend of mine, we went down to down the street from the Regent Theatre in Oshawa for dinner. And we ended up at an Irish pub called Riley's, and I must say, for an Irish pub, they make a pretty fine gyros. Lamb. Man. Succulent. Lip-smacking lamb gyro. Who would have thought of it? Anyway, Oshawa, if you've not been, it's a university, college town. It's really, you know, moving in a different direction. It's not just, you know, about cars anymore. And so while we were there having our dinner, it was quite a few students hanging out at the pub, and someone in the booth next to us pulls out a deck of tarot cards. And I have to tell you, I know next to nothing about the tarot. Truth be told, a little wary of tools of divination. You know, I think I've stated it publicly on the air. I avoid, even as a youth, I didn't mess around with the Ouija board. And I had friends. I used to work on the road with for an engineering company, and a good friend of mine, Bill Guscott. Bill, if you're listening, hello. It's been too long. Get in touch. Bill and I were roommates on the road, and he, as I recall, was pretty heavily into the tarot. And all I remember is, you know, these enigmatic pictograms on the cards, and you know, we're familiar with some of the more common ones: the juggler, the hanged man, death, of course. And some of you may use the tarot as a tool of divination. Some of you may be wary of the tarot's roots in the occult, and maybe you just avoid the tarot. I don't know, but regardless of how you approach the subject, I felt it was high time that we discussed tarots on the program, the tarot. And my guest tonight, well, let's just say we go right to the top. We always aim to get the most qualified, the most esteemed experts on the program, and when it comes to understanding the tarot, few are more qualified to discuss than Rachel Pollack, who is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the modern interpretation of the tarot. She's also a poet, an award-winning novelist, and a tarot and comic book artist. She's published 12 books on the tarot, including the seminal work 78 Degrees of Wisdom, which is considered a modern classic, and the Bible of tarot reading, if I can use those two terms in the same sentence, or those two words, Bible and tarot. It's a marriage of common sense, wide-ranging knowledge, and esoteric awareness has inspired many tens of thousands of readers worldwide to a deeper knowledge of the tarot. She's a member of the American Tarot Association, the International Tarot Society, and the Tarot Guild of Australia. With fellow tarot author Mary Greer, Rachel has taught at the famed Omega Institute for the past 15 years. She's been conferred the title of Tarot Grandmaster by the Tarot Certification Board, an independent body located in Las Vegas, Nevada. As a fiction writer, Rachel has been bestowed many honors and awards, among them the famed Arthur C. Clarke Award for science fiction for Unquenchable Fire and the World Fantasy Award for Godmother Night. She's a recommended member of Penn International and has written for numerous publications. My, my, we are in good hands tonight. Rachel, welcome aboard The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction.
Can you give me a complete neophyte in this area, a five-minute crash course on the tarot? How does it work?
Okay, well, how does it work is a big question. I have to, whenever someone asks me that, I'm reminded, did you ever see the comic Irwin Corey, Professor Irwin Corey, years ago? He would come on in this sort of sloppy outfit, this like tuxedo and sneakers, and he would give this sort of rambling comical lecture. Then he goes,
oh, yes. Now, yes,
Johnny
the sneakers.
Leno,
yes,
right?
Yes. Now yes, I remember.
Yeah. And they were always primed. So they would always say to him, why do you wear sneakers? And he would say, you ask a two-part question. Why has plagued philosophers through all time? And we go on to this for a minute or two, and he'd say, do I wear sneakers? Yes. So when people say, how does a tarot work? I always want to say, you ask a two-part question. Because, I mean, those of us in the world of tarot, you know, we don't really have answers, and anyone that pretends to have an answer is kind of faking it, I think. People bring in, like, large theories. They talk about quantum physics and entangled particles and Carl Jung's synchronicity. But no one really knows what's going on, except that you take a bunch of random pictures, as you said, pictograms, a nice way to discuss it, actually, and mix them up. And somehow the pattern that they fall into is like a tiny reflection of the person's life issues. And sometimes it's general. So, you know, someone is asking about why she or he doesn't have a partner, and it goes into issues of, you know, loneliness and issues of parents having had a bad marriage, so there was a bad example. You know, and this will all be true, but it won't be like a surgical precision. But then sometimes, especially when there's a real need, when it's a big issue for a person, the card that comes up will be unbelievably accurate.
Right.
It will be like the one card in the deck that really gives this person the message that they need to hear. And I just think that that's, you know, a phenomenal thing.
Well, describe some of the more common pictograms we're familiar with and what they mean. I mean, it's not like Sigmund Freud said, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Not so with the tarot,
no,
right?
No.
I mean, death is not
symbolic.
Death necessarily.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, part of our quick five-minute tour would be a little history, which is that a lot of research has gone on in recent years, and it seems pretty definite that the tarot actually began as an allegorical game in northern Italy in the early part of the 15th century, like 1430 or so. And using images that mostly people would recognize, it was like a pope, an emperor, and so on, but also some more mystical ones, like someone peering at the stars, or to, you know, someone in the bright sunlight, or someone flying through the sky. Very beautiful images. And they captured the imagination, but for a while they were used mostly as a game. And we don't have any real evidence of them being used for divination, but it seems impossible that they weren't, because everything that is used for game is used for divination. So, you know, anytime you have a pack of cards, people are going to start doing divination with it.
And why 78 cards, Rachel? Why 78?
Well, because that's an interesting question. You know, it's a little hard to pinpoint how that happens. But the thing that makes tarot special is it has an extra suit. So there are four suits. And in tarot, the suits have their old-fashioned names of wands, cups, swords, and coins, or sometimes today pentacles or discs. And so they're almost the same as playing cards in the old decks. The modern decks all have pictures on every card. So in the modern decks, for example, the four of cups is likely to show someone sitting next to a tree and looking at three cups, looking kind of unhappy, and then there's another cup coming from a cloud. excuse me, in the altar decks, it would just show four cups. So it would be pretty similar to playing cards. There was an extra card in the suit called a knight. Instead of Jack, Queen, King, there'd be Jack, or sometimes Page, Knight, Queen, King. But otherwise, they were like playing cards. So anyway, but what made Tarot special was this extra 22 cards. These 22 cards are now called the Major Arcana, which means, Arcana means secrets. And these were the symbolic pictures. And just as a game, the idea seems to have been, if you want to play a game like Bridge, where like, you know, one suit is Trump, which just means a triumph over the cards, it'd be more fun to have a permanent Trump suit and to have that suit be beautiful and have that suit be incredibly symbolic and rich and layered, you know? So that's what made the tarot, those 22 cards. And over time, they became more and more deeply symbolic, more and more kind of a spiritual lesson, and also, obviously, more and more available for interpretation. And then the so-called minor arcana of the four suits also became more available for interpretation, especially when 100 or so years ago, a deck came out called the Rider deck, which is the most famous tarot deck in the world, that had pictures on every card, like about that four of cups they were telling you, about that man sitting next to the tree, and so on. So now you could actually look at the four of cups, instead of having some automatic answer in your mind, you say, okay, what's going on in this picture? Well, someone seems unhappy. Is he unhappy? Is he bored? And a lot of tarot readers will actually ask the client, when the card comes up, they'll say, look at this picture. What's this man doing? What's going on with this person? And this goes against the image that, you know, we've been taught of the completely psychic tarot reader that we see on television who says everything, and the client never says anything. But a lot of times in modern tarot, people will have the client interpret the picture to a certain extent.
It's more interactive, right.
Yeah. And because it just says a lot about the person. You know, there's a card called the Seven of Pentacles in that same Rider deck, which shows a man leaning on a hoe. He's a gardener, and he's looking at a bush of some these sort of stars growing on it, you know? And people look at that, and one person will say, I always say to the people, you know, what is this man's attitude? And one person will say, well, he's really tired but happy his work is done for the day. The next person will say, well, it's morning and he's looking at all the work he has to do and he's horrified at how much work there is.
Half full,
so,
half
that
empty.
Tells you something, you know?
Right. Rachel, listen, we've got the music percolating up here,
okay.
which means we're going to ease on into a break. You stay put. We'll come back and we'll continue to discuss tarot and divination with an expert. Well, we only bring you the best here on The Conspiracy Show. Rachel Pollack is with us. The book is 78 Degrees of Wisdom, Parts 1 and 2. Don't go away. And we're back, and we're learning about the tarot as a possible tool of divination. Fascinating, a 78-card deck. And, of course, we're all familiar with some of the major pictograms, like the juggler, there's also the hanged man, which is kind of a misnomer. Explain what the hanged man looks like, because it's not what we, you know, the image that we conjure up is, you know, someone on the end of a noose. It's not that at all, is it, Rachel?
No. It's a man who's tied by one leg, so he's upside down. And he's tied to just like a, kind of like a T-shaped thing. Well, actually, it's like a, whatever, it's just, you know, tied to a crossbar. So it's not a noose at all. And he's tied by his ankle, and then his hands are behind his back. We don't know if they're tied or not. They could just be behind his back. And the leg that's not tied, is crossing the leg that is tied. So it's like a figure four, which is like, you know, a man standing on one foot with his other foot crossed behind his knee. And the scepter's upside down. And it's a very interesting card because some people find it a card of being stuck, having to sacrifice something. They find it very dire, but I find it very beautiful because in the deck I use the most, his face is filled with golden light. So it's kind of initiation, it's attachment to your own deepest values. I often imagine a kind of intervention, you know. So there he is, he's hiding from his tree, and his face is filled with beautiful light, for he's having visions or something. And his friends come and they say, you really should come down from the tree. That's not a good thing to be doing. You should go back to work. And he says, well, thank you very much for sharing. Because, sees beyond criticism. So it can mean your own values, doing what you know is best, believing in yourself. Sometimes it can mean you have to do nothing for a while. You have to just let things develop because there's nothing you can do for now. I don't know if you know the Chinese and Japanese divination system, the I Ching.
Yes, yes.
Which often tells you to do nothing. It just says it's not the moment for action. Just don't do anything.
Don't do anything. Yes,
yeah,
I'm all about the I Ching.
Like that. I Man could be saying, do nothing at the moment because there's nothing that can be done. Just wait.
Yes. Now the death card, it rarely or probably never indicates physical death, correct?
Well, sometimes it does. But it does where death is in the air in a certain sense. So, for instance, I did a reading once for someone who had a relative in an old age home or who's near to death. The death card came up, so it was pretty clear. It was addressing the issue of this person's final days. The fascinating reading I did once, I did a reading for a Swedish man who was doing AIDS research. And one of the key cards in the reading was death, was called reverse, which the card comes up upside down. So it was literally saying the possibility of his research reversing death from AIDS. It was, I never found out what came of it, but I hope that he was part of the medicine that really has helped a lot of people.
But it would I would guess that it would be irresponsible for a tarot card reader to pull up the death card and then suggest to the person who's having the reading that, they may be dying or have some physical ailment.
Well, see, normally I would never do that. Because that's taking too much responsibility.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes you feel like you just have to because there's so much else that's supporting it, There's a card that looks like a funeral and so on. But the death card normally, really, though, it just means the end of something.
And what
and
is
it
the...
means the end of something that you really should let go of.
Right,
you know?
Change.
Like a bad marriage, a job that's a dead-end job. So it's really kind of telling you a message. It's saying, look, what you're doing now isn't helping you. It'd be better if you just let go of it.
What about the devil card, Rachel?
That's fascinating. The devil card's really interesting, because it can mean a lot of things. One of its meanings is addiction. So if it comes with other cards, there's a suit called cups. And sometimes if the devil comes next to the king of cups, I might say to someone, is there any question of alcohol in the situation, But the devil card means to be trapped in some way. It means to feel like you have no choice in life, And it's an illusion. It's a fake. Because the people in it are chained around their neck, but the chains are big enough that they can take them off and walk away. So with the devil card, you have to look beyond it. You have to say, okay, I may be feeling trapped in life. I may feel everything is dark. But that's a mistake. There's things I'm not seeing. Then you look at other cards and say, well, what are you not seeing? What can you be looking at? I will take you beyond this devil,
So the effectiveness or the quality of a tarot card reading is really dependent on the person who's interpreting the tarot. How does one learn to do that?
Well, for me, I just started doing it. I got a deck of cards in 1970, and I got this little book that came, but didn't come with it, but I got the book in the same store. And I would, learn how to, gave instructions how to do a reading, and I just started doing readings. I'd put a card down, I'd look it up in the book, but then I would sort of make connections, take off from there, maybe make up a story about it. But some of those readings were phenomenal, I knew nothing, basically. And yet, I discovered, for instance, all my friends were having affairs.
Seriously?
It was really embarrassing at times,
You discovered that your friends were having affairs through the tarot?
Yeah, yeah. So some married friend of mine said, can you read my tarot cards? And I'd say, sure. I'd put the cards out, and there it would be. It would be so obvious this person was having an affair. And then we would talk about it, and, they would say, yes, that's true. That's what's going on,
Well, what was the card that came up that convinced you?
It would usually be a combination of cards, It might be like a card that, a marriage card, say, upside down. It might be a card that means a new relationship, a new lover. There's actually a card now in modern tarot use called the Seven of Swords, which shows a guy tiptoeing away from a tent, having seemingly stolen a bunch of swords, and he's looking back, smirking. And a lot of people now see that as the card that signals someone's having an affair, that specific card, one of its meanings. But so, I did that. I also helped two people evade a lawsuit they would have lost. because it's a long story, so I won't go into it, but they had worked for a boss who was harassing them, two women, and he really was beyond the pale. And so they quit because they couldn't take it anymore, and they were thinking of suing him. And he was a red-haired man. And when I did a reading for them, and the justice card came up upside down, which can mean that justice is not going to happen. And then the next card was the Five of Swords, which shows a red-haired man defeating two people. So I said to them, well, it's your choice. I'm not going to tell you what to do. But the cards are saying, if you go ahead, you're going to lose. Justice will not be done. You will lose. And 6 months later, the next two women sued him for the same kind of, you know, practices. And the judge was his buddy, and it was thrown out of court.
Wow.
And since he was actually, it was actually a federal agency, so it would have been the same judge. Whoever sued him got the same judge.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
Rachel
so
Pollack is with us.
People, you know, lawsuit.
Rachel Pollack, world-renowned expert on the tarot and author of 78 Degrees of Wisdom, which is described around the world as the Bible of tarot readers. At what point did this become not just a diversion for you, Rachel, when you actually believed that tarot is, it works. It's a useful tool for divination.
Well, pretty early on when I started, like, really helping my friends, you know, see things and understand things and found it, you know, helped me, too, to guide me in certain choices and things. It just seemed so, from the moment I saw it, it was this amazing experience, actually. I was teaching at a college, this was early 1970, and this teacher said, oh, would you like your tarot cards read? I said, okay, sure. I knew nothing about it. And as soon as I saw them, I just thought, I have to have this. This is amazing. I remember nothing of what she said about the reading. So it wasn't the reading. It was the cards themselves. They just called to me with this really powerful kind of message.
Well, admittedly, I mean, the pictograms are provocative and impressionistic,
yeah,
which is obviously the whole point to it. They have to be impressionistic. But they're also quite beautiful. And I didn't realize that you can have sort of individual, personalized tarots made. And you wrote the text for the tarot cards for Salvador Dali?
Not exactly. I wrote a book about it after they came out.
Okay.
I was commissioned by a publisher. Unfortunately, I tried to reach Dali for comments, but he was too old and frail at that point. That was fascinating work, though, because it was so interesting how he did it and how he chose the pictures. But I also have written. I collaborated with a German artist named Hermann Heindel, who was a brilliant artist.
And yes,
he had done most of his pictures, but then by the time I met him, he was not finished. So I got to have some influence on some of the later pictures. And we worked together very, very intensely. We spent weeks going over every picture.
So he would do his version of the death card or his version of the devil.
Yeah.
Or I would love to see Salvador Dali's deck. That
it's
must be absolutely wild.
You know, online, I'm sure.
Must be wild.
It's quite expensive. And the book I did is probably more expensive now because it's very rare. There's not a lot of copies around.
78 Degrees of Wisdom, Parts 1 and 2. I mean, that has become, as I say, the Bible for tarot readers.
Mm. Yeah, that's something I've heard from people all over the world. They're just not copying each other. People just say to me, oh, I just think of this as a Bible of tarot readers. I heard that from store owners. I've heard that from just people who bought the book. I've heard that from professional tarot readers, you know. It's just that that book's had a huge impact, actually. It's very special for me to have written something. It's had such a gigantic impact in a community that's important to me.
How do you use the tarot for you personally in everyday life? I mean, do you make all of your decisions based on the tarot?
No.
No,
not at all.
How does it work for you?
Yeah. In fact, sometimes I'll avoid using it. I have to make, say, a serious medical decision because then I just might scare myself, you know?
Right, right.
We talked about the death card, not meaning death, but if you're facing a medical issue, a death card comes up, you kind of freak out. So, no, but I mean, what I'll do often, though, is I'll just do three cards for the day and see what shows up, you know?
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but maybe after we'll be heading into a break in about 4 or 5 minutes. Do you have a tarot handy?
Sure.
Just maybe, it might be useful. I don't want to be, too self-indulgent here, but it might be useful just as a demonstration for those not familiar with tarot. Could we do a few cards for me?
We can, it's more difficult. It would be good if you had a deck, but we can do them, connection over the phone like this, over the radio.
Oh, traditionally, both the person...
Well, traditionally, the person getting the reading shuffles the deck.
Right.
So it's his energy. But I've done it this way before, and it's worked really well.
All right. Why don't we do that in a few moments? Rachel Pollack is with us, the author of 78 Degrees of Wisdom, of Parts 1 and 2. Throughout history, you know, we know that certain world leaders were very interested in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
Numerology, of course, played a huge role in the Reagan White House. We're told that mm-hmm. Nancy Reagan rarely made, you know, decisions without numerology in terms of planning Ronald Reagan's itinerary and so forth. Do you know of any world leaders from history or even currently who are big fans of the tarot?
You know, I don't offhand, but I think that's partly because tarot has always had a bit of an unsavory reputation, and I think they wouldn't want to admit it.
Why is that? Why does it have an unsavory reputation?
I don't know. It's interesting. I think because you know, if you think of astrology is about the planets and stars. People understand that, so that makes sense to them. But if you think of just a bunch of, you know, sort of bright pictures on cards telling you something meaningful about your life, it's a bit scary. And then somehow, some strange ideas have come up about the tarot over the years, you know? Including the idea they come from the devil, maybe because there's a picture called the devil. But they're actually very Christian. And that's why there's a devil, because the devil is an important issue.
Now, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you whether there's, you know, if anyone is of the Christian persuasion, whether they should be avoiding the tarot. But you're saying the roots of tarot... Mm-hmm. are in part Christian. Tell me more about that.
Well, because those 14th century, like 15th century symbols were Christian symbols. You know, there's like the Last Judgment, which the dead rise up. There's a pope. There's a figure usually called a female pope or the high priestess, but she also could be like, you know, an abbess from a nunnery. So it's a very Christian kind of set of images. And somehow, though, the ideas... developed, I'm not sure from where, that it's actually something satanic, but there's no evidence of that whatsoever. And I think it's also, some people just have a fear of divination. The idea that somehow you can learn about the future is very scary to people.
Well, the Bible does sort of warn against that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, but it also has diviners, you know. Joseph, the son of Jacob, in the Old Testament, is a diviner. That's one of his main things in life. And he's called that. He's very specific. Now, he doesn't just interpret dreams. He also uses a cup. He divines by looking in a cup. And then there's Daniel, who interprets dreams, and so on. So it's actually, you know, it's a mixed message. And the prophets, of course, predict the future, too. So the question, I'm Jewish, and I think of it something, you know, how the Jews look at it. And the Jewish point of view is that it's not a matter of whether prediction is true or not. It's a matter of whether it's spiritually beneficial. And so as a tarot reader, and most tarot readers I know have the same attitude, you know, we're very concerned that whatever we tell somebody is of their benefit, that it helps them at this moment, helps them in their path in life. It frees them rather than restricts them. These are important, you know, these important values.
Is there a connection, you mentioned that you're a Jew, is there a connection between the tarot and the Kabbalah?
Well, this is a very big thing that's gone on for quite some time now, about a couple hundred years. There's probably no historical evidence that the Kabbalah was the inspiration for the tarot. But if you think of how it just fits so perfectly, because in Kabbalah, everything is about the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and there were 22 of these so-called major arcana cards. Then also in Kabbalah, there's the Tree of Life, which has 10 positions on it. Then you have the Suth, which has 10 positions, or, you know, 8 through 10. And then there's also in Kabbalah the four-letter name of the divine, the most sacred name in the Bible, and then there are four court cards. So it just all fits together so perfectly. It almost seems impossible that it's not connected, you know. But this way of looking at it developed over the last 200 years, and now it's completely entwined in the tarot.
All right, Rachel, stay put. We'll take a time out, come back. We'll open up the phone lines, questions or comments regarding the tarot. We've got the world-renowned expert right here for you. Rachel Pollack is the author of 78 Degrees of Wisdom, parts 1 and 2, and about a dozen other books regarding the tarot. Back with more, including my own tarot reading, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. Next week on The Conspiracy Show, award-winning documentary filmmaker, best-selling author Rob Skiba discusses aliens in the Bible. We'll delve into who or what is an archon. Who are the Nephilim? How did they return both before and after the flood? Who are the sons of Anak, and where did they come from? How tall were the giants the Hebrew spies saw that made them feel like grasshoppers by comparison? Why should we be concerned about the act of mixing animal and human DNA? And why did Jesus say that the last days would be like the days of Noah? That's Rob Skiba, right here on The Conspiracy Show next week. Right now, we are continuing our discussion about the tarot with Rachel Pollack, author of about a dozen books on the tarot, and she, of course, is a world-renowned expert and the author of 78 Degrees of Wisdom, which is described around the world as the Bible of tarot readers. All right, Rachel, here's where I get a little self-indulgent, and we're gonna do a little of my tarot reading here. Okay. So how do we begin this? How does this happen?
Well, the first thing is you have a question or an issue that you want to look at.
All right. Let's see. How about, finances are always an issue. How do you see my financial situation unfolding over the next year?
Okay. So I've mixed the cards during the break, and I'm going to cut them into three piles and then put them back together again with the bottom pile on top is the traditional method.
Okay, these are face down.
And we'll see what we get. Okay. Okay, so let's do three cards to start. The Four of Wands, which is a very joyous card. The Ten of Swords, which is an unhappy card. And the Page of Pentacles. So what I'm seeing here is the Four of Wands looks like everything is great, you know? Celebration, joy, happiness. But then something goes wrong. The Ten of Swords is a setback. And it's a setback that you worry too much about. The Ten of Swords is a very extreme picture. It's a man with 10 swords stuck in his back.
But often it means hysteria. Hey, I work in radio. I'm used to that.
Yeah. But often it means hysteria rather than actual harm.
Okay.
You know, I don't exaggerate, but it's, you know, worry, over-worry.
That's me.
Yeah. So after that, those two extremes of, like, everything going wonderfully and then suddenly, like, there's some setback.
Right.
We get a card called the Page of Pentacles, and pentacles are often about money. So that's like, you know, stepping back, looking at things, maybe being a bit more cautious of investments. Let me see what comes after that. And then the Eight of Pentacles, which is working hard. So it may be that some investment doesn't work out, and you take a fresh look, and then you have to build up, you know, your portfolio or whatever. And it's just, you know, it's just working hard at it and getting somewhere. And then the Emperor card comes up. It's also number four, like the first four of wands. That's like getting back in control. So that's like, you know, by not letting that setback throw you, you work hard and you're back in control and, you know, really back in charge of things. And then one more card, so it's like 3, 2, 1, is a card called Temperance, which shows an angel pouring water from one cup to another. And it's the card that comes after death, so it's a kind of like rebirth card. So it's a 14. Four is connected to the four is the Emperor. This is 14. And temperance is about being very balanced and steady. So it says that, like, you know, after whatever that setback was, after the fight to get back control of everything and feeling strong again, you learn the lesson of not going to extremes. Temperance is like the middle way.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the very telling, because I do, I think I would, I think it's safe to say I have general anxiety about most things. And so, yeah, perhaps it's telling me I got to step back and relax a little bit.
Yeah.
And everything will turn out well in the end. Is that a fair summation?
What I'd say is I would caution you against over-optimism and then over-pessimism. Because those first two cards, they like swing wildly.
Right.
The Four of Wands says, oh, everything is just perfect. Everything is wonderful. And the Ten of Swords, everything is a disaster. So then it becomes a question of stepping back, looking at what the reality is, working hard, getting back control of everything, and then just settling down.
And typically when you do a tarot reading, how many cards deep do you go? I mean, you went, what, about a half dozen cards there with me?
Yeah. I just did a 3-2-1 pattern.
A 3-2-1 pattern?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Three cards and two, then one. That's just the way it came out. Because it seemed like there was another step to be taken at each point, you know?
Right, right.
But I'll do, there's a reading I tend to do. It's a very famous one called the Celtic Cross.
The Celtic
which
Cross.
Which is 10 cards.
10 cards, okay.
So what I do is I'll often start out with that, but before I do the reading, I have a discussion with the person about their issues. You know, if you'd come to me, we might go into more of a discussion about your finances and more, you know, detailed stuff. And I would write down everything you say, you know?
Right,
And then after the 10 cards, giving us a general view, I would turn over two or three cards for everything you said. And sometimes we end up doing the entire deck, which is quite amazing, you know?
Well, this was very instructive. I think it was useful doing this demonstration, and
yes.
I certainly have some takeaway, some things to think about. Rachel, stay put. We'll continue our discussion. Rachel Pollack is the author of 36 books of fiction and nonfiction, including 2 award-winning novels, and, of course, 78 Degrees of Wisdom, a world-renowned expert on the tarot. I'm back with more of my conversation with Rachel right here on The Conspiracy Show, and perhaps we'll have time to work in a call or two. Stay with us. Welcome back. Rachel Pollack stays with us as we discuss the tarot and receiving some emails here, Rachel. And okay. Beth in Aurora wants to know whether a tarot deck has to be given to me before I can work with it.
No, I don't know where that idea came from either. You know, some people say give it or you have to steal it, which is a really weird idea. I was once told by a tarot publisher that bookstores kept tarot decks under lock and key because people believed they were supposed to steal it. You know,
it's like Abby Hoffman's book, Steal This Book.
Yeah, right, exactly. But the fact is that, you know, I bought my first tarot deck, and most of the other ones I had, so I had about 600 tarot decks, and I bought all of them pretty much. Well, actually, some of them were gifts, but anyway. No, you don't have to wait for someone to give it to you.
All right, and now we have someone, I think it's Genevieve in Buffalo, is asking about, now I don't understand this, but I've come to the right person, something about a switch of the 8th and 11th card. The old decks, the 8th card is justice, the 11th card is strength, and now in many modern decks, the order has been reversed.
Right, yeah. What happened with that is, I don't want to go into all the details of it, but it had to do with a group of people who were very dedicated to the study of tarot, and they wanted to link it to astrology. And it made more sense to have the 8th card, Strength, which shows a woman taming a lion, be Leo. And the 11th card, Justice, which I think is Virgo, something like that, I'm not sure, might be wrong about that. But the point is, it was just the way the order of things fell in the, constellations and planets in astrology. But I actually find it extremely meaningful, because 11 is the middle point of the deck. So to me, having Justice at the exact center is very meaningful and important. It says that, you know, this is the point to which you have to balance everything. You have to balance the scales or you can't go further in life. I think that's an important message, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. By the way, I have to tell you something that I was thinking about this Emperor card that came out in your reading. I was in a bookstore once giving a talk about tarot, and, you know, people wanted, like, quick one-card readings.
So is that possible?
So the bookstore owner said, what can we do to improve the city that she was in, the city of Newburgh, New York, which was having some tough times. So there was one card, it was the Emperor. And so I jokingly said to her, you have to take over the city. You have to become the Emperor of Newburgh. And afterwards, someone said to me, you know that she's running for mayor?
There you are. Did she win?
I just thought that was wonderful.
Did she win?
No, unfortunately not.
Mm.
But the card's saying if she had won, if she had become emperor, the mayor, then she could have improved things, yeah.
William is in Aurora, just north of Toronto, and he wants to know, is there a code of ethics for tarot card readers?
Some people make their own. There's some various, you know, tarot associations and tarot guilds do put together a code of ethics. Some of them say you should do your own code of ethics and, you know, display it. But in general, most tarot readers agree on a whole bunch of things, that you don't manipulate, you don't lie, you don't do, like, you know, con artist kind of tricks. You don't take over someone's life. You don't scare people. You know, the basic ethical position of most tarot readers that I know, at least, is that you try to be helpful. You try to help people move forward in their lives rather than take over their lives in some way.
Do you think tarot can predict the future?
Well, it's, you know, it certainly has in certain situations. I wouldn't bet on it, if you see what I mean? You know? And so if somebody comes to me with a question about the future that's really important, like, for instance, whether or not to have a surgery, you know, I would say to this person, you should never make a decision based on a tarot reading like that. But here's what the tarot says. So I will say what the tarot says, but I'll say to them, you know, you need to speak to doctors, you need to, you know, do your research. You should never let any kind of divination be your only way that you make a decision.
And can you do tarot on yourself, or should you have someone else do it?
It took me a while to be able to do that, but now I do it all the time for myself. So there's not a rule about it. It's a little difficult because you tend to give yourself simplistic answers. You tend to panic more easily. You tend to think everything is perfect more easily. But after you've been doing it for a while, everybody does tarot for themselves.
What makes a good tarot reader?
I think it's someone that has the ability to respond to images and to intuition.
Is that a right brain, left brain
skill? Well, I guess it's primarily, right brain, left side of the body, intuitive side, you know? But it's also the creative side. I'm not sure what part of the brain is the creative side. Because basically, a tarot reading is like a story. You know, you're inspired by the pictures and by your intuition and by what the person is asking about. All these things come together to produce a kind of story of the person's life that the person, you know, will find meaningful, hopefully.
What about these? I understand that there are tarot computer programs. Do they actually work, or how do they work?
I personally like the feeling of human beings touching the physical cards. But the way they work is there's a randomizing algorithm. So, you know, you click on it, and then it goes blip, 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 and brings up, say, three cards, which have been chosen supposedly at random, even though some people say there's no such thing as random. But more or less random, you know. And then there's an official interpretation that the person who made the program has written for each card. And some of the better ones will have the meaning in terms of love, the meaning in terms of finances, the meaning in terms of work, the meaning in terms of spiritual path, and so on. But what they can't do is combine them. You know, the way I did the reading for you, in which I combined the pictures.
Right, right.
You know?
Yes.
Because, there are 78 cards. You can just imagine the millions of possible combinations. So that's the limit of computer programs. But also, I just feel there's something about the human connection that's very meaningful.
Absolutely, absolutely. Is there, some of these cards have numbers, but are you employing numerology in combination with tarot, or do the numbers, is it something quite apart and different from numerology?
Tarot has its own numerology to some extent. It's a little different than what we call classical numerology. A friend of mine, who's also a tarotist, is a numerology person. She knows it very much more than me. But one thing I picked up, studying with her and learning with her, is that it doesn't quite match. The numbers aren't quite the same, you know? So you have to kind of get into the tarot numbers.
And do you find that people that are into tarot, are they also into things like classical numerology, astrology?
A lot of them are, not all, yeah.
How about you?
I've picked up things on astrology from friends, so I know a fair amount of it, but I'm not an astrologer. To me, what I love about the tarot, as compared to both astrology and numerology, is it's not fixed. You know, if you do your birth chart, it's always going to be that birth chart because you were born at a certain point, right?
Right. Fate.
And then you can progress it up to the present, as they say. You have your astrological chart for this present moment, but that's still not going to change. And so, the moment changes. Whereas in tarot, it's very fluid. You know, you do another reading, you get a different point of view. And I like that constant fluidity that the tarot has. I'm not someone who likes memorizing lots of things. And in numerology and astrology, you have to memorize a lot. So tarot, to me, is more intuitive. I mean, I know all my astrology friends and numerology friends are going to be screaming at me for saying that, because I'm sure that, numerology is very intuitive. Well, I know it is from friends of mine,
Tell me about
that's the way it feels to me.
You, Rachel, you're a member of the Tarot Guild of Australia. I never would have imagined that there is an actual guild. Tell me about that.
Well,
what is a Tarot Guild?
A great group of people. I've been to Australia 4 times. I think it is. I'm going again in February. It's always from the guild. They sponsored me to come and teach. And what they did was, it was really started by two women, I guess in the 90s. And they decided, they were both professional tarot readers. They decided they wanted to, you know, raise tarot to a higher level. And so they started gathering other professional people, people who wanted to learn. They set up a system of learning. And they have a code of ethics that people are expected to agree to and to post in their consulting room. One thing I liked about them when I was, you know, learning about their way of doing things was that you had to take a test to show your, you know, your level of expertise after you'd been studying for a while with a teacher. But you could choose your approach. So, for instance, if your approach was all about tarot and Kabbalah, that's what your test would be about. If it was about tarot and astrology, your test would be about that. And but, you know, so they just allowed people to follow their own path, but then they had to show that they were at a professional level. And it's still going. It's been going for a long time now. And they made me an honorary member because I came to their first, they had the first international tarot conference in the world, actually, early 90s. And I was an invited guest, and they made me an honorary member of the guild, which I think is wonderful. And I, you know, I continue to have contact with them. Like I said, I'm going back for my fifth visit, and I'm in February.
So,
which I'm very excited about because I always wanted our summer, their winter. Their winter's not very cold, so it wasn't too bad.
Christmas,
you know?
On the beach.
But now I'm going to be going from like 10 degrees here to Fahrenheit to 90 degrees in Melbourne, Australia.
There you go.
It's going to be an amazing experience. I'm really wondering what that will be like.
Rachel, final question, and you know, this is obviously, we're running out of time here, but are you any closer after all these years to figuring out what is at work with tarot? I mean, are you in contact with the divine? How does this work?
Well, you know, I think it's really hard to be a tarot reader for a long time and not feel there is some kind of spiritual or divine energy that allows these cards to fall in such meaningful ways. And like I said, sometimes it's, you know, general advice or something that's worthwhile, but sometimes it's unbelievable, you know. I've done readings for people which have changed their lives, quite literally. You know, I did a reading for someone that's very well line of sage from being locked in a madhouse because of something her husband was doing. I did a reading for someone that, you know, I can't go into too many details, but I mean, one time I did a reading for a woman in London where I was reading in a shop, and she had a reading and was very powerful. And then a friend of hers came for a reading a little later in the day and said that this woman wanted me to know this was the most important day of her life because the reading had unlocked something that was so deep in her, that was so powerful, that it blocked her whole life. And then the reading just, you know, let her see what it was.
That's remarkable. Very gratifying.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's wonderful to have those experiences.
Rachel, thank you for this.
Thank you.
I enjoyed talking
great
with you.
Time. Thank you very much.
RachelPollack.com is the website, RachelPollack.com. My thanks to Tim Spreen for technical production. My story producer is Albert Vinzel. Back next week. Hope you'll be aboard for that. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.